Radio. This is David Woolner.
And Barnea Levy-Sullivan.
You're listening to Landmines, brought to you by Foundation Stone. And Barnea, we have the opportunity to sit and introduce to the general public a very interesting character. Who's in the studio with us today?
I'm going to make an attempt to say his name. It's the curator in the Bible Lands Museum, Philip Vukosavovich. Close.
Very
at least
nice.
Close.
No, actually, it was fantastic.
Very good.
You did a better job than my wife, so...
But we're not going to ask you to spell it.
But we had the pleasure of going to the museum and being Philip's guest, and that's a video portion of this Landmine segment. And at that point, no one was brave enough to try to say his name. It's only after a month of the holidays and with practice...
I'm going to take exception. We sat with Philip at the memorial service for Shlomo Musayev, and I got extra credit from Philip for pronouncing his name correctly.
That's correct. That's good.
One time, correct. I'm not going to try to do it again because I don't want to push things.
I appreciate it.
There is something unprecedented, I believe. I'm prone to exaggeration, as all those who know me know. Without exaggeration, I'm prone to exaggeration. I believe there's something unprecedented about the presentation of the exhibition and the catalog by the Rivers in Babylon. And Philip, who is sitting here with us, wrote every word of the Hebrew and the English, except those parts that Jeremiah the prophet or others wrote. And I have never before seen an integration of the Bible, the body called the Babylonian Chronicles, which we should talk about, and the archaeology so well. Now, there's something very unique about the find that is the center of the exhibition, and those are the tablets of the Al-Yehudu community, and Philip will tell us about that. But the presentation where I go from the verse to the Babylonian account of the events and to the archaeological remains, starting from the time of the first temple and going through the destruction, and then hear this community in Babylon and making that story come alive, as was said in the two-day conference at the Bible Lands, it's shedding light on a relatively dark period. And years of work went into this. Now, I find the whole topic painful, to be honest, because it's based on thieves. Thieves found this hoard, realized its value, knew where to find the collectors, sold it to the collectors, and thank God the collectors saw fit to let the scholars know we have it, and scholars worked on it. This by itself is a topic which maybe we can get into. There are those that say,
this issue was recently part of the City of David annual conference where they talked about the looting of antiquities. That's this was right. A major part of the presentation. We should probably do a separate show on that topic.
Right. And
Colonel Bogdanos, really.
And Colonel Bogdanos has agreed to be interviewed for the program, so we may have a program on that later. He communicated with us very nicely. But that's a question of whether there should be an acknowledgement of the scholarly world of the value. Does it encourage more? This is a world unto itself. Be that as it may, through the efforts of museum personnel and scholars, these documents have been published. The fact that there's a corpus tells us a lot about this Jewish community that followed the dictum of Jeremiah in chapter 29, go build houses, invest,
settle.
You'll be settled. There's going to be a return, but your job now is to settle. And that's what we see in these documents. And again, we discussed it in the museum, and Philip will here discuss it here. I'm just giving an overview. So it's an absolute pleasure, Philip, to have you with us here in the studio.
Here.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got from there to here to be in this position?
It's a long story, actually, but I'll make it as short as possible. So I was born in Montenegro, which is a really small country, formerly part of the former Yugoslavia. When Yugoslavia fell apart in 1991-92, so all the former republics just separated. So I was born there, not really much of a Jewish community at all. I was there until the age of 25, I believe. Then I moved to the States. I was on the East Coast for 4 years.
Why did you go to the States? Why did you leave Montenegro?
I actually, my family has a friend who teaches at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. It's a Christian seminary. And at that time, he told my mother that if Philip is interested in anything else, to study or to see the world, whatever, so I'll take care of him coming to the States and doing something new. And at that time, I already finished the law school in former Yugoslavia, and I was practicing law in one of the local courts. And you know what? I just packed and I left. I left career and law and whatnot, and I went to New England, to Boston area. And I actually studied Hebrew Bible at this Christian seminary. I was there for, altogether, New England for 4 years. And in 2001, actually, while I was still studying, finished my MA, I came to Israel for archaeological excavations.
Which one?
At Tel Hatzor.
Tel Hatzor, okay.
Up north, right? And what happens to many people happened to me. I just got infected.
Got the bug.
I got the bug. I got this Israeli bug and just promised myself a year later I will be back for good. I was back exactly a year later, starting Ulpan, learning Hebrew, starting my second MA in the field of Assyriology, ancient Near East, history, culture, languages. After a few years, I started my PhD. So today I'm Dr. Philip Vukasavovic. I'm happy to say. And in the meantime, I also found a job at the Bible Land Museum, where I've been now for this is my 12th year. Mm. I started as an assistant curator to Dr. John Gooding Westenholtz.
A blessed memory.
Zichron Lag Vracha, that's right, who passed away just a couple of years ago of cancer. And after she retired at some point, I just took over. So ever since I was there, ever since I enjoyed working in the museum, learning a lot about not only Assyriology, but many other fields, like art, Judaica, archaeology, many other fields. So...
So the Bible Lands Museum is a fairly unusual institution that its focus is very clearly delineated. You go to the Israel Museum across the street, you've got a little bit of everything,
right,
or a lot of everything.
Right.
But what's the focus? What would you say is unique about the Bible Lands Museum?
It's ancient history. If you want just a couple of words, it is ancient history. We, unlike the Israel Museum, which is history, archaeology of the lands of Israel itself, of Eretz Israel, land of Israel, we are more focused on the lands of the Bible, meaning cultures, regions, languages, religions, anything else surrounding the land of Israel. So in a way, we fulfill each other. So we start the history around the beginning of Neolithic time period, 9000 BC. We go all the way down to Talmudic period, so approximately 10,000 years of history. So there is a lot there, a lot, just plenty of material, plenty of cultures, plenty of languages, plenty of items. We're talking about hundreds and thousands. But since I took over, I also like to implement more modern art, medieval art, to try to connect ancient to modern and show how ancient history develops and how impacts us to this very day. So as you saw in this exhibit and other of my exhibits, you will always see medieval art, you will see modern art, you will see all kind of things.
It adds
which
color
actually,
and how exactly, human society appreciated
it. Which are
it.
Relevant. For people who don't know ancient history, for them to just come and see ancient artifacts very often means nothing. So, but connecting and making these connections is for them is like softening the approach or introducing them to ancient through development all the way to modern. So
it gives texture.
It gives texture, absolutely. So it's not only plain archaeology, gray or dark. It's as you say, it's texture. It's
avira. And then the cartoons. There's always something for the children.
Can I suggest a word? It's the context.
Yes.
Okay. It's really the environment.
Yes.
For the emergence of Western civilization. But you can see very clearly there the commonalities of the cultures.
Absolutely.
And some differences.
Absolutely.
Of the cultures.
Absolutely.
But it gives the environments in which Western civilization, where the Bible was born, and
absolutely,
the influences and the interactions of those cultures with each other.
Absolutely. You know what? I just recently for Wynet, I wrote an op-ed writing exactly on these lines, that we don't understand the richness of culture in the Middle East, that, you know, wheel was invented here. We settled down as humans first here. Writing, you know,
alphabetic
legal
writing.
Courts, everything, yeah. You know, cuneiform legal courts, schools, you name it, it's all here. And you know what? Many of these things we do to this very day, and it has its origin right here. So when we explain to people in these terms, it's easier to grasp these ideas of ancient and how it develops to modern. So, so I'm trying to incorporate everything together, and it'll make it as,
rich.
As rich, but also as digestible for people as possible, so people can say, ah, well, I know this. This is like 100 years ago. How this relates to something 3,000 years ago? So it's a struggle, because today, ancient history, ancient art, ancient anything is just something which is dying out. It's almost passé, and we have to revive it somehow. So I do believe that the Bible as a museum, at least with our exhibits, which we do almost on an annual basis, we managed to make this connection and to show how relevant it is. And I do believe we succeeded with By the Rivers of Babylon.
Which is being extended to May 15th.
Actually, yes. We were supposed to close it on February 1st, which is exactly the year since we opened, February 1st, 2016. But we extended for 3.5 more months, all the way down to May 15th, which is actually going to cover an entire school year because of the interest, because of schools that are coming and so on. So it's
Do you have any idea how many people have seen the exhibit so far?
Over 100,000 for sure. It's just incredible. We see throughout the cultural institutions in Jerusalem, Israel, a huge drop because of the situation in Israel and war last year and so on. The Bible and Museum has seen a 30% increase in the visitors. 30.
Amazing. Yeah.
So it's absolutely amazing for the people. So we have over 100,000 people already seeing it. We may see actually many more thousands. So we are really proud of the work we have done.
So from our point of view, from Brené, right, this is not just an important conceptual presentation, it's also done beautifully, and you can see clearly the investment of the displays and the range and that and that's terrific. What if I were to tell the audience that's listening to this, if you're coming to Jerusalem, it's not only a must see. It, as Barnea was saying earlier, it's talking about a period, or it's presenting a period in history that people in general don't know a lot about. And so I think people will be surprised about how rich a period, not just the presentation, but the period itself, how rich culturally it was, and how the people who were really coming from the exile and destruction of Jerusalem and Israel were able to adapt and to transform and to morph into a society that can
Absolutely.
Now be successful in the diaspora.
Absolutely. You're both right. It's definitely the most, I say, maybe the most pivotal events in the history of the Jewish people, because it shaped who we are today. The exile helped us write the Bible, complete the Bible. The exile eventually made us write Talmud. The exile did this, the exile did that. So if it wasn't for the Babylonian exile, three of us probably wouldn't be sitting here talking about this event. So it's, again, it's an incredibly crucial event for the Jewish people, and very informative, absolutely, very impactful. So what starts there keeps rolling to this very day, and it's simply impossible to ignore this event. So
Barnea, right, Jerusalem itself was affected by the diaspora, the Babylonian diaspora. Okay, how do we see historically the influence of the Babylonian diaspora? I'm putting you on the spot because you didn't expect this question. The Babylonian diaspora on the rebuilding of Jerusalem in the Second Temple period.
That's a big one. While I'm thinking, I just want to say something very funny that I just realized. I was going to say that we have been promoting people going to the exhibition, which is part of why we're doing it now.
Thank you very much.
And extending the school year allows a new opportunity to run programs there. But I just realized another reason why it's ignored. You know, you often open up a book in a library and in the yeshiva in the school, And the first few pages are very well worn because everybody starts it. This entire story is at the end of Chronicles. It's at the end of Jeremiah. It's the end of Kings.
Yeah. That's right.
So I may have learned, but it came June. That's they right. finished the year. We got up to chapter 21. But this is in chapter 25. So it's another right. reason why people don't get to it because right. it's the end of the book.
Right. That's right.
And actually what your question focuses on the... I just one more side point. You see over here on the shelf here, Walking the Bible and Abraham by Bruce Feiler. Bruce Feiler is a New York Times bestselling writer who's right now in town preparing his book on the love between Adam and Eve. So we asked, could we meet? And that I said, I'm going to be out of town. And he said, you must go see this exhibition. It's on... He said, okay, I was planning to be at the Israel Museum at this time. I'll run across the street and I'll see it. So we really are pushing it. And if he likes it, so you may find it publicized a little bit more. There is a major question which my mentor in Tel Aviv University, Professor Oded Lipschitz, has taken head on. This is his main claim, is that... he calls it, it's not just his phrase, but it has to deal with the issue of the myth of the empty land. In other words, on the Bible says, and the land was left empty. On the other hand, it clearly says that there were people left. And for the exhibition itself starts the moment when the first temple is still there. The warnings, the destruction, I'm very struck by that pot, which may have been a defective pot, but may be warped out of shape by the heat. So this is the difference. I think we discussed it then between an archaeologist and historian and the tour guide. The archaeologist and the historian has to say there are two possibilities for this pot. But once you have the tour guide license, there's no question that you say, look at what the heat did to this pot, because the story is much richer.
Sorry, with a tour guide license, you can say anything you want.
That's right. That's right. So you definitely go with that line. And then takes us through the exhibition isn't focused on the immediate return. The exhibition has this hint, I'll tell the story again, even though we have it in the museum view, has this hint that ultimately people will come back from Babylon. And you have that movie, I have tears coming to my eyes just thinking about it. You have that movie where the man in Babylon telling his children about, we really come from there, maybe one day we come back. And then you had this person who I think in 2010 made it out and said, when I came to the exhibition, I realized I'm that person, that I made it back. That was very moving. Okay, but our story, your question in terms of Jerusalem is that there's those that left and those that stayed, and then the leaders of the Babylonian Jewish community now come back to Judah, to Jerusalem. What is the interface with the people here, with the people here in Benjamin, with the people here in the country? To what extent is it empty? What do we mean by empty when there's clearly people? What is that sense? What was lost in the exile when archaeologically we see a continuity in many places? And there are places where we don't see the impact of the exile, particularly in Benjamin, which is going to be a point of focus of Professor Lipschitz and Professor Finkelstein this coming year. You see a continuity there. Is the story of Ezra and Nehemiah is being presented by the people of Babylon the way they see it? We will say that since the Torah incorporates that, that's the version, that's the way the people of Israel, the Jewish people, are meant to understand it. Stepping out of the book from a historical point of view, you can question and say, if you were a person who was sitting here the whole time and then these guys show up and come back, do you have that same perception of, you know, where have you been? You know, we've been sitting and working here. All of a sudden, you've arrived. You know, we're back. Thank you. We never left. And to some degree, that is the way Israelis, homegrown Israelis, so to speak, of a generation, three generations, look at the people who are getting off the plane like we're back. You know, but I once heard Mutta Gore speak at the first Jerusalem Fellowships group, of which Lori Palatnik, who just landed today, she was from the students there. Now she brings thousands of people here a year. And he explained, I hope it's recorded, he explained the difference in the Israeli psychology between 1948, 1956, 1967, 73 war, and Tebbi, as the original feeling being that there's two separate nations. There's the people who are sitting and living here, and some of us have that feeling here this morning. Yes, we're watching horrific attacks in Jerusalem and throughout the country, and my cousins are posting about their Halloween party and how wonderful it was, or about the ball game, or about, they're in a completely different space. Yeah, so we're the ones who are actually part of the history of Israel and the people of Israel and the formative events of today, which are shaping the future for everybody. So not that we didn't leave. We all came from outside of the country, but like we're here. So, oh, you came. I remember the, boy, am I off topic. I remember the,
I wasn't sure where this was going.
I know where I'm going. In the first Gulf War, they had, it's announced January 15th or whatever it was, is going to be a war. So you had these chizik, these reinforcement, encouragement missions from December 21st to December 25th, and they come from the Federation or from the this or from the synagogue with the gas masks around. You say, okay, we're with you. Bye! Right? It was nice. We came to strengthen you. Bye! As opposed to those who came to be here in that time. So one is the interface between the people who appreciate we've come back and the people who are here the whole time. So like in the book in the Nehemiah, which is happening later in the story, hey, what happened over here? You've married foreign wives, you're not keeping the Shabbat, and I'm coming from the outside saying, hello, hello, get back to where we're supposed to. I'm here to press the reset because things here have degenerated. In Jewish tradition, Ezra sets up together with his court, sets up prayers and everything, because people are now have absorbed all types of different languages. They can't express themselves in prayer to God properly in Hebrew, so they codify something to express all of human needs in Hebrew. But no, the impact of the exile is felt. The appreciation, the dedication, we're going to rebuild the altar, we're going to rebuild Jerusalem. That's definitely coming from the power of being there in the exile. But as to exactly how it's shaped, and we know it's shaped, right? They come back and they don't sanctify all of the land. They make the borders smaller. That affected us this past year in the sabbatical year. The borders which have the sabbatical year sanctity are a result of the Ole Bavel of those who came back from Babylon. And they didn't completely expand out to the original boundaries. They dealt with the current situation. And yet, in a sense, that return is sensed to be more powerful. It stays forever, even though the second temple was destroyed. The sanctity is even more entrenched and affects us today, as opposed to there are trace elements which still affect us today, but nowhere close of the original coming. So definitely a transition. The impact of the calendar, which we'd like to discuss today, being as this is Rosh Chodesh Cheshvan, we'll get to it in a minute.
Mar Cheshvan,
and the names,
right,
of
the Babylonian names,
the names of the months are in Babylon, okay. And still at least four of the months in Turkey are Shevat, Elul are still there, Nisan are still there now, and so we come back with a different sense of calendar, a different sense of time, and the prophet says that you will now remember that you came back from there through talking about, this is one of the ways, as the Ramban explains, that we remember that we came out of Babylon because we are deliberately using those names as opposed to just saying the eighth month, and that's a lead into our conversation about Mar Cheshvan. So it left its mark, the reforging of prayer and various other enactments of the men of the Great Assembly together with Ezra is a reaction to a new situation. They've been exposed to a world culture. There's a different consciousness. I don't think he's the only one, but Dr. Irving Finkel from the British Museum has a whole position on how the Babylonian Talmud gains from the thinking that they gained from Babylon. It's a different thought process, which is now embodied in the Jewish heritage in little children today are thinking and analyzing things differently because of the Babylonian process, well, Aramaic.
You know what the irony of the Babylonian Talmud is that it became the preeminent Talmud in the Jewish world as opposed to the Jerusalem Talmud, but the scholars of Israel at that time viewed their Babylonian compatriots as being inferior. So, and some of the
in some
and,
sense
and,
in some
yeah,
places,
and the Babylonian scholars came to Israel in order. Right, for the greater learning, the greater scholarship.
Right,
very interesting.
But then the Talmud says that somebody who did that, who had that exposure, right, and then comes to Israel, right, is worth
richer,
more,
right,
is
yeah.
rich more for that. On the other hand, you miss the purity, and you have, of course, the famous Reb Zeira fasting to forget the Babylonian Talmud, so he would be here.
Immersed.
Very nice balance.
So, but Philip, we have you here. We could sit and talk all day, which is what we normally do. Right? You have an interesting perspective, so to speak, is that you're able to see the whole picture from an academic point of view. Okay? If you had to synthesize, to simplify the message of this exhibit, what would it be? You're in an elevator with me. We're now riding to the top floor of a 20-story building. You got a minute to tell me, what is the importance of this exhibition?
Survival, renewal. It's a good question, actually. I never thought in these terms, one word or two words. It's definitely a personal story. It's definitely an emotional story. Story relates to one person, but also his family and the whole nation as a whole, right? It's a story of a change. It's a story of a huge change, how Jewish people viewed itself, how it operated, how it moved forward, how it survived, and how it really became a survival then for 2,500 years to come. So it's in so many ways it is a story of what happened then, but it's also a story of what's happening to this very day on a daily basis. So the Jewish history of Israelites, right, is packed with these events over and over again. And this one is really one of these starting ones, the ones who really brought a huge change. So you can really view this story or this event from all kind of angles. Prophetic point of view, or just personal point of view, geopolitical point of view, religious point of view. It actually depends what you're looking for in the exhibit, but you can really learn a lot.
I want to contend that it's because it's personal that you see a particular family and the history, a little bit of that
in
family,
the documents, in the tablets.
Right? What made the Syrian crisis that's going on now so powerful recently was seeing that picture of the little boy washed up on the beach. It became specific about one story, and that became a microcosm for telling the whole story. It was, you know,
it gave
some
a
people,
face. That's
some
the way
people
it's said.
Dismissed the Holocaust because 6 million is just a number, and it's very impersonal. When you start talking, and this is what we did in the States and other places, when you bring in a survivor and they can tell their story, so you're telling one story,
right.
And I think that's part of what gives the
yeah,
power
it,
to the. To
it
the
was really intentional because you know you usually go to these exhibits usually. A lot of archaeology, a lot of history, a lot of text, go read and learn.
Right.
But once you really, as you said, bring it to a level of a single person who goes through all of this, it becomes much more than that. And as one of you said, I think Barnea said, there was this Iraqi Jew, the last Iraqi Jew who left and saw the exhibit, and he said, listen, this was me, but just 2,500 years later, it really, you view it on a completely different level. Especially because all those people in the exhibit were real. I have not imagined anything. I didn't write these Hollywood scripts, you know, let's invent this guy or that guy. Everything is real. And as Barnea said at the very beginning, it is the best documented story in the Bible with these extra biblical sources, both archaeology, texts, and so on. So we really were able to give it something special, right? And this emotional side is personal, is really important, which we like to emphasize.
I'd like to clear the slate now, and for its own value, and also for those listeners who didn't yet see the video or haven't yet that we made or haven't yet been to the museum. Could you talk about the find, the archaeological find that is the heart and that triggered the exhibition? And then you helped or you conceived the exhibition. What is there and what is the story being told? What does one see when one comes to the museum? What are the components that you included in it?
So, as we already discussed in the museum, this was a perfect story because we have this triangle of information. We have Bible telling the story, Book of Kings and Jeremiah, some other books. We have extra biblical sources, like, as you mentioned, Babylonian Chronicle number 5, some other Aramaic or Judean sources, whatnot, and we also have archaeology. So these two, three together really offer us an incredible opportunity to reconstruct the story of the Babylonian exile. So that's exactly what exhibit is. It consists of three sections. First section is pre-destruction Jerusalem section, where we simply discuss the geopolitical situation, the Middle East, before Babylonians come and destroy Judah and Jerusalem and the temple. We discuss who, we discuss why, we discuss when, we discuss where. We simply talk about what is happening. Why? Is there anything special about Jewish people, or it's actually happening to everybody? So first section is exactly that, and all the items in the section, is it archaeology, is it text, is it art, is it movie, whatever it is over there testifies to this period before destruction. And then the second part is definitely the most emotional one, because it is, as I say, minute after destruction. We are in Jerusalem and we see ashes. We are in Jerusalem and we see collapsed walls. We are in Jerusalem and we see destroyed houses. We see life that existed, which is simply no more. So the color of that section is different. The movie which we show is different. The type of items are different. Everything is different. So lamentations, destruction. We show photo from archaeological excavations. You know, often we say we don't have photos from the time period, which is actually not true. Once we go into archaeological excavations and we get to the layers of Babylonian destruction, we see exactly how Jerusalem and Judah looked like from the time period. Whoever visited Jerusalem week after Jerusalem, 2 days after Jerusalem, actually saw exactly what we saw, what we can see in archaeological
right, when the photos. Verse says that these houses were burnt, you absolutely, see the burnt house.
Absolutely. So, and I bring in the exhibit all these photos and so on. So you see the calamity, you see the effect of destruction, not only physically, but also emotionally on the people. So that's the second part. And then we go through a gate, a Babylonian gate, symbolic Babylonian gate, and we enter Babylon or Babylonia itself. So it's already the third part, and of course, famous Psalm 137 in the Book of Psalms, by the rose bubble there we sat and cried when we remembered Zion. And then in the last part, we simply offer a Babylonian environment. Again, colors change, again, environment change, again, items change, and the story change, everything changes, and we follow this family of Haggai, son of Ahikam, and his great-grandfather survived. He was exiled from Judah. He goes to Babylon and he establishes his family over there. And he's the one who narrates the story. And he's the one who is there right now in the year 504. And he tells his nephew and his friends the story of what happened. So it's really chronological story. It's family story. And once you're in Babylon, you see you have the feeling of Babylon. We have a beautiful model of a Babylonian village where a Judean family or Judeans themselves will settle down and they will have no choice but to start the life all over again. And that's what Judean people really do. The earliest of these texts from the Elihud Chronicle is already 15 years following the destruction of the temple. And you already see not struggling people. You really see people who already established themselves in any way or form. They have businesses, they have families, they have houses. some of them already work in Babylonian administration. Nobody's crying anymore for Zion. They definitely know. They definitely talk. They give their kids Jewish names, of course, that they maintain the Judean or Jewish identity. But
for 100 years. Hmm? For 100 years.
For 100 years at least, absolutely. And even more afterwards, because we have another Murashu archive that also documents Judeans later on. They simply continue their lives, but they are there. It's like American Jews in America, or French Jews in France, or South African Jews in Africa. We simply continue our Jewish identity. Not everybody does. Some really get assimilated. We also see that through these texts, but it's really an incredible story. And then we finish the story in 539 BCE, even though, as I mentioned, Haggai tells this story to his nephew and kids in 504, but the story technically finishes in 539. Why? Because Cyrus the Great and Persians conquer Babylon in 539 and release all the exilic peoples. I say peoples because it wasn't Judeans, it was Philistines, it was Phoenicians, it was Syrians, it was Anatolians, it was some Egyptians, Arabs, you name it, they were all there at this time period. So it's not only a story about us as well, it's a story also about other people who were there. And we see in these cities where these texts were written, where they were exiled, where they settled down and lived, you can see a Judean visited a village where Philistines lived, right? Philistines. Or visiting a village where Syrians lived, and so on. It's just a mishmash of people, a mix of people who live in the same place. It's actually reminiscent of what's happening today. It's hard not to make these parallels of so many cultures, so many religions.
I think
so
there's
many,
a huge difference. Okay?
Well, at least when it comes to the milieu, when it comes to the range of people and so on. Of course, today it's different because different ideas, ideologies and so on. But to see everybody is in the end together, they have to, work together, live together. It's really amazing. And today we just
I make the joke of Barnea periodically. I repeat myself because I'm old enough to forget what I said 5 minutes ago. But I when we travel, right, you see this on the airlines. Jews don't go get on an airline, right, to travel. They're not travelers. They move on to the flight. They move in, right? They bring everything they're going to need for the next week or two, right, with them right there on the flight, and they're there, and their seat becomes their abode, right? Everybody else, all the other people, they're there. They're a little bit standoffish. They're a little bit uncomfortable. Jews are bad refugees because they immediately, as quickly as possible, become parts of the cultures that they find themselves in. And this is a historical occurrence that repeats itself over and over again.
That helped them survive.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. So we could discuss in a sociology program, right, why that is part of the Jewish culture, but it seems to be pretty indicative. And so were many of the other cultures that were around them. The cultures that we see today that are migrating and they're staying as refugees. They're staying separate from the predominant cultures around them and not even trying to integrate into the different countries. In Europe, for example, so there are some serious differences, in my opinion.
No, there is total today, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to pull you back now. Please describe the archaeological find, which is the heart and the trigger for the whole exhibition. What is the Al Yehudu find?
Okay. So-called the Al Yehudu archive is a collection of texts, just like any archive we have today. Approximately 200 plus texts, which are for the most part in two major collections. David Sofer collection, who lives in England, and Martin Skoen collection in Denmark. And then a few other collectors like Shlomo Sayev, that have a few pieces here and there. The incredible importance of this archive is that documents the daily lives of the exiled Judeans in Babylon following their exile.
I just want you to clarify, please, for the listeners, when we talk about documents, we're talking about clay tablets.
That is correct. We're talking about clay tablets. Some of them are really the size of a matchbox, right? That's small. Some of them are bigger, maybe like iPhone. It just depends. And they're made out of clay. When clay is wet, that they impress the letters, if you want. It's actually signs. And they dry, and they survive actually for thousands of years, unlike paper that disintegrates. And they're written in Akkadian language, which is actually dead Semitic language, but that's why it's easy for us to read it. So these texts, which are...
It's not easy for us to read it. It takes a scholar like you.
Joan could read it like a newspaper.
Right.
Joan was Joan Weston,
former chief cook,
was not able to read it like a newspaper.
Maybe Joan everybody else. In other words, it's not written in alphabetic writing. It's written in cuneiform.
Maybe 100 people in the world who can
read it like that
to do it. Yeah. But it's Semitic language, so we can actually understand the language, unlike, let's say, Sumerian, which
is not Semitic.
Not Semitic, not anything. Not Indo-European, not anything. It's hard for us to get it. In any case. So these documents, this archive, these 200 texts, document the daily lives of the exiled Judeans, which is stunning because we have approximately 250,000, at least, maybe 300,000, maybe even more texts of this type, which were discovered through archaeological excavations or stolen or whatnot, but we have it in museums, private collections.
All over the world.
All over the world, absolutely. Especially in Europe, United States, and in the Middle East. But none of these texts, none of these 250,000 really focuses on Judean people in the exile, or people at all in Babylonian exile. And here you have approximately 200 texts which focus on the Judeans, and not only. We also have Egyptians, we have Philistines, we have some other people in the area, all of them that suffered, also Babylonians themselves, during the same time period. So we see people in their own daily setting, right? Like three of us sitting and talking about this. So we see them discussing their daily transactions, determining how much tax a family has to pay based on certain issues.
Marriage issues.
We have actual texts talking about discussing or just describing the inheritance of five sons after the father passed away in the month of Tishrei, which is the September of 504 BC, right? So we have many of these texts, which, you know what, in many ways are extremely boring because they remind us today of legal... where they are legal, of let's say, contracts which you go to a legal office to be stamped. It's exactly that. It's what is the transaction, if there are witnesses, who wrote, a lawyer, right? And when it was written, where it was written, and there is a stamp. Is anybody going to today go to a law office, look for these texts, and really get excited? Nobody. Unless really those who like this stuff. Then again, these texts offer us incredible amount of information about Judeans, about their families, about their lives. Because in addition, we know for each part in a transaction or each witness, we know who his father is. Sometimes...
because that's the custom, because that's what the name was.
So, Selivan, son of...
Amos Selivan.
Huh?
Amos Selivan, Amos.
Right?
So from that you know what the name, right?
But sometimes in this transaction, your son also appears as a witness because you have you need a legal witness. So sometimes I actually know up to 3 generations or 4 generations, or in the case of this exhibit, we have up to 5 generations in the same family. And you know what? That's non-existent in the history of the Jewish people until relatively recently. That we have text, ancient text, which is 2,500 years old, ancient texts in plural, right? That can reconstruct based on them 5 generations in the same family. We have men, but we actually, lucky for us, we also have women. And I can say, and I said that the hero of our story is Haggai, son of Ahikam, but I also know his grandfather, which is Raphayama, and I also know his great-grandfather, which is Samakiawa, and I also know his nephews, So all of this together, their brothers and uncles and this and that, everything is incredible, incredible. So that's what Ali Yehudu archive is. It's a collection of approximately 200 texts. In the museum itself, we have 100 of these texts. 70 we displayed in exhibit, which is actually a huge amount of texts to display in a single exhibit. And they simply focus on Judean people in the exile, which is absolutely stunning. And we have never had it on this level in the history of the research.
Now, it's one village. They were apparently all in one place. And it's 100 years of the life in this village, in the archives. So again, in terms of a general find, although there are many finds from Babylon, but to have this focus, not in a big city, and one of the scholars said, you see, it's relatively poor. I'm putting in one cow. You'll put in the cow and the horse, and this will give the feed. It takes four people to put together a team of oxen to handle a field. That's people who are eking out a living. They're not living like, but it's 100 years of one place and the family tradition to be traced.
Yes.
No parallel to
you're
it.
You're absolutely right. I mean, somebody mentioned poor. They were not. Many of them were not poor. We can see their socioeconomic condition, and some of them were rich. Many of them are actually rich. One of the reasons why many of them don't want to come back to the land of Israel after they're allowed to go back, because they have their lives over there, established lives, businesses, jobs, you name it, fertile land. It's all there. Now, you mentioned apparently in one city. So yes, you can. We can assume that after their exile, many of them settled in a single city. Then again, this archive covers the time period of approximately 100 years. People multiply. People have sons and daughters and grandkids, as we see in the archive itself. And we have many of these texts not only written in Ali Yehudu, which is actually the city of Judah, which is actually Jerusalem of Babylon, but we have at least a couple of dozen other cities where you see they reside, they do businesses, they go for visits, and so on. So you see that after 100, 120, 130 years of exiles, not one exile, a number of exiles from Jerusalem or Judah to Babylon, you see a thriving Jewish community in Babylon. So it simply helps us understand what is happening over there. Were they slaves? Were they miserable? Listen, some of them really didn't succeed. Some of them were slaves. Most likely those actually wanted to go
or
back to
Israel. Indentured servants.
Exactly, or whatever. Go back, maybe start all over again. But we see actually a rather positive picture of the Judean exiles in Babylon. Okay, because so, the intention of Babylonians was not to enslave them, but simply help them build the Babylonian economy and the empire, and actually they really helped.
Right. I want to contrast, okay, another historical period that we have a wealth of information, the destruction of the Second Temple. Right, much of what we know about that period comes from outside of our parochial Jewish sources, comes from Josephus. And what we have is a historian really writing about a major event and a major chapter in Jewish history from a very personal point of view. It's so personal that he writes one history for the Jews, another history for the Romans, but it's all coming from his point of view. The I think power of the collection that you have is that this is dispassionate. This is not someone's personal perspective. We're someone opened a window for us into life of this 100-year period.
Correct.
I have documents and I have records that show and illustrate, so I don't really need to interpret it or try to decide how much personal bias the recorder had, because it's just the facts, ma'am. I'm just giving you the picture of the society without any embellishment, because they weren't writing history.
You are very correct. History is very rarely objective, and what we have is really, again, legal contracts. That is not to be biased about legal contract or not, but actually gives us wealth information. I have to admit, I never thought about this angle when it comes to this text, but it's absolutely true. Nobody can tell me, this is how you interpret, because, you know, you're Israeli or Jew. No, I mean, these are really black and white, exactly what it is.
And they weren't trying to show off, and there's
exactly.
No metaphor. There's
exactly.
This question of the empty land or not. It, in my eyes, is clearly a metaphor, because at the same token we say it's not, but I wanted you to have that sense. So there's nothing literary. Is there anything literary here? Are there any poems?
No, actually,
no. There's
nothing.
The marriage document. There's a few different types of legal documents.
a marriage document which is not really between Judeans. There are Judean witnesses to this marriage document, which is not even in the museum, but there are most administrative documents. You owe me this much money, I owe you this, you sold me that, I have to pay this much tax.
And everything is dates. Everything is Tmeir. Everything is dates. I can't let your comment go by without quoting for the umpteenth time Dr. David Lukens and the Tobias family's Iraq El Amir as we sat there with the Schwab family. Listening to the story of the destruction of the Second Temple from Josephus is like listening to the story of the American Revolution from Benedict Arnold. It is such a classic line. We have to quote it. The Mosaic piece is the one that mentions the river Kfar, which appears in Ezekiel, who is there.
Standing by the river.
River Kfar. That's the unique aspect of that one, in terms of the places.
Incredible. First of all, we learn a lot from Ezekiel itself. But again, because it is Bible, and many people are skeptical about what it says, so we need extra biblical information.
The resonance, to know that there was an accuracy in the geography and in the details, and that such things as keeping track. Say, who kept track of dates in ancient times? Look at these documents from the exact same time. Know this thing. It's the 30th year. It's the 5th month. It's the same language.
I thank you for mentioning. These documents mention a date, a month, and a year of a certain king.
So right,
we
please
know
talk about that.
Absolutely everything when it comes to it. But let's just get to Ezekiel for a second. So Ezekiel says, I arrived to the exile community which sat on the river
Kvar
or Hebar, I'm not sure how do we say. And we do have a document where it says, written in a city on the river Hebar or Kvar, which is incredible that exactly what Ezekiel says, we have it. That's why we approximately know where it is. Now,
and Ezekiel, when the first document is written, not necessarily that one, Ezekiel's still there. It's only 15 years after the destruction.
Because Ezekiel is exiled in 597, 10 years before destruction. So when Jerusalem gets destroyed, Ezekiel knows about it. This first text, 15 years after destruction, Ezekiel is most likely still alive. So many of those exiled Judeans knew Ezekiel personally.
He's talking to them, and Jeremiah is sending messages to them.
Absolutely.
Also,
you're making a point that I make when we go out on tours and do our educational programs, and that is that in archaeology, and obviously with museum as a follow-up to that, what archaeology can do and what museums can show is that the context that is revealed through archaeology of the Bible is spot on. We can't tell you whether a particular event happened the way the Bible describes it, but the context of the Bible is absolutely accurate. So when people mention a river in this context, or people mention a site, or the type of things that are going on at that time, whoever is recording those events was intimately knowledgeable about the societies, about the groups, about the names, the languages that they're writing about.
So let me give an academic answer, okay? When it comes to Bible, it's all on the case basis, okay? So you're absolutely right about, let's say, Babylonian exile, because when it was written, it was really while everything was ongoing. So the memory of
Kvar
River,
fresh.
Everything's still fresh, absolutely. Whoever writes the Lamentations, maybe Jeremiah, maybe somebody else, actually sees the city and he writes
in flames,
probably,
right.
Absolutely, probably writes it with tears in his eyes, right? However, there are different biblical stories much earlier, which is either impossible to prove, so it's all on case by case basis.
Exactly.
It's a good
and
point.
In but this case, we have a lot of information.
An early story, and I'm going to just use it as an example, the story of Joseph, right? When the Bible introduces Egyptian names and Egyptian sites, those seem to be confirmed by research. But research doesn't yet have the power, maybe it never will, to say that the event happened, but the context of that story seems to be fairly consistent.
They wore linen.
And accurate.
So I have a book, it's not Uri Oz, I'm sorry, I forgot the name. I have a book about the flora and fauna of Israel. And in the introduction he says, I know that there's discussions about the dates of writing and the authorship of the Bible. I just want to tell you from my perspective that in terms of flora and fauna throughout the 24 books of the Bible, it's spot on. That's his perspective. I had a year-long course about...
Even though we no longer have lions, roaming right. around freely in Israel. There was a time right. when there and people we won't were afraid discuss of lions.
Now the dating of camels. We'll get over that hump. But the I had a year-long course from Professor Israel Finkelstein, Dr. Erez Ben Yosef, about Jordan, and they spoke about how the geographical descriptions in different books of the Bible is stunning, and exactly this is where the rainfall ends, and that this valley, and you sense it and you see it in the landscape. Can you talk a little bit about the different kings, the progression of kings, and the dating in the tablets?
Only approximately 10% of the tablets were written during the Babylonian time. Okay, meaning from the time of Nebuchadnezzar, we have his name in these texts, his dates, but also his successors. So we do have in this text. But most of the kings mentioned in this text, 90% of them are Persian, from Cyrus to Darius to Artaxerxes and some other
ones. Which means after the Babylonian Empire fell absolutely, and was succeeded absolutely. By the Persian Empire.
So you
Empire.
Mentioned already 100 years of the span of the collection of the archive. So the collection starts at 572 BCE, which is 15 years exactly after the destruction of the temple, and it goes all the way down to 477. So if the Babylonian Empire was conquered by Persia in 539, so you can see it's almost additional 60 years down to 477. And in the exhibit we show both the first tablet, first text and the last text. But yeah, most of the texts were during the Persian time period, and the kings over there are Persian.
I'm a little bit used to it now because I've been to the Israel Museum, I've been to the British Museum, to others, but recently at the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World, where you see papyrus documents, when you see the name Ahasuerus in print, when you see the name Nebuchadnezzar, when you see the name Cyrus, when you see the dating system, which resonates when you're reading the verses, it's just very exciting. You know, it's not our heroes, you know, it's all the villains, except Cyrus and Darius, Daryavish, it just comes to life. And then you say, oh, it's not just what I learned on the Wednesday in class, and will this be on the test or not on the test? That the resonance of the reality of we date by the kings. As a child, I learned the tractate of Rosh Hashanah. They dated documents by the kings. And then the rabbi tested us. Did we remember what was on page 2 and page 3 of the tractate?
Not a chance.
And you just see it. You see, yes, this is what they're doing. They're using the names of the dates of the kings and the months. And today is Tishrei, which resonates with the earlier month of the document you made of Tishrei.
Today is the last day of Tishrei.
Right? We have a 2-day Rosh Chodesh of Mar Cheshvan. And you put up on the BibleLand's Facebook page today, and he asked people who can recognize, you know, where the word Cheshvan appears over here. So we're nearing the close of here. Speak for a moment, please, about the name Mar Cheshvan and the Babylonian name.
So one of the impacts of Babylonian exile is that Judeans simply took the month names, which are known throughout Babylonian history for hundreds and thousands of years. And so one of these months is Cheshvan, which is the 8th month both in Babylonian and in the Jewish calendar, if you count from the 1st of Nisan, which was the normal way of counting. And actually, Cheshvan in Akkadian is actually Varach Samanu. Okay, Varach Shamanu, Varach Samanu, which simply, Varach is for Yareach, which is moon, and Shamanu is simply Shmone in Hebrew, which is eighth
month.
Okay, so the month simply, the name of the month simply says Shamanu, which is the eighth month, right? Of course, that's kind of switched in Judaism from Varach to Mar Cheshvan. So our understanding of what Cheshvan is today is definitely much different than what it was 2,500 years ago. But Varach Samanu is simply a very plain Akkadian name that simply says
for the eighth month.
That's right. All
whereas we talk about the bitterness of the emptiness of all the holidays, are any of the other months focused on the number? Or is it the only one that's focused on the number? The others have to do with planting, with agricultural meanings.
You won't put this in the interview. I actually don't know. I can check this out for you. Yeah.
Okay. I have a question.
Wait, well, do you have in the temples of Larsa, there is this little brochure. I'm not sure if you have it at home.
I own it at home. I don't have
it
here.
Okay,
so actually it's over there. I could have checked. Yeah.
And maybe you don't know the answer to this question either. The Hebrew calendar is not a purely lunar calendar. It's intercalated with the solar calendar so that always in Nisan comes out in the spring, right? The and the Arab calendar is not. It's a purely lunar calendar. Is the Babylonian calendar intercalated with the solar calendar, or is it purely a lunar calendar?
So yes, so it's intercalated. And Judean calendar, Jewish calendar, comes directly from the Babylonian calendar. We literally inherited the calendar. Our rabbis were smart enough to say they already Babylonians brought it to perfection. Why reinventing the wheel? Where we can actually use exactly the same thing. So they used exactly the same type of calendar. The only difference is that intercalated month in Babylonian calendar could have been Adar or Elul. In Judaism, it's only Adar. So what is it? 7 times in 19 years?
They add the transition of either season in the Babylonian calendar.
So we add 7 times in 19 years. We add additional
second
month.
Second Adar.
Exactly, right. Second Adar. Babylonians did exactly the same thing. Actually, they were the first to start this, but it was either Adar, sometimes it was Elul.
Right. Our tradition is that we had it before. It's already going back to the Mosaic tradition, but you have a clear historical basis for it.
You see, in Babylon, it works.
In
the Bible, there is not a single reference to Babylonian month names.
Right. It's the month of...
First, second, third, fourth, right. Fifth, up to 12th, or these were Canaanite month names. I think we have only three of them in the entirety of the Bible.
But that's not in the five books, like in the Ziv, like mentioned in the Book of Kings.
In the book of prophets,
we have some hits,
right.
Yes, yeah, exactly, the later books.
This has been terrific.
I just want to ask, what's your favorite find? What is your favorite tablet?
Of these hundreds?
Of the exhibition that you picked. What touches you that you say, ah?
What is my favorite find?
Journalistic question. You know, it's good to bring it down to one item, you know?
It may be the inheritance text. Because it does show us an aspect which we haven't really seen before, okay? And it is ongoing in the month of Tishrei. And it's just a couple of days after Tzom Gdalia. So I like to ask people a question because I think it is on 7th of
Ben
Tishrei.
Ben Achikam. Gedalia ben Achikam,
which
is our name.
All kind of interconnected. Right. So I'd like to ask people if they already fasted on that day. If in 504 they already know what Tzom Gdalia is, it already established, which most likely is already. So many intriguing questions coming through this very text. I don't know.
It intriguing.
From Ali Yehudu, I think that one is the...
And it's still new. We still have to analyze. We have to think about it.
Absolutely,
Philip is going to Atlanta this November to attend the Society for Biblical Literature Conference. There's going to be one session on the Ali Yehudu tablets where he's not speaking, but he'll be an interested listener and participant in discussions. And another one about ancient law. And as a lawyer, he has the sense of it. So when he says about, you know, who's going to look at the documents, somebody who has a background in archaeology and in law can give us an insight into the implications of it that other people can't. And we look forward to your insights as a result of the conference. We'll be down the block, right, running the program.
And we look forward to the next exhibition from the Bible Lands Museum.
Yes.
Philip,
do you know what it is? Do you know what it is? Do you have a hint?
Yes.
Coming attractions.
Here it comes. No, this is, we're getting a scoop. Maybe.
Well, it's probably off the record. But it's most likely about Hirbe Keyafa. You heard about a site where Yossi Garfinkel excavated.
We were involved
found
in the excavation. Yes.
So there you go. So all the finds are available. I think I'm doing an exhibit just on that. It's going to be pure archaeology exhibit, but the planning is going to be
this
off
has been
the
fantastic. Thank you so much for coming to the studio, making the trip. Barnea, thank you too.
My pleasure.
A pleasure.
And thank you for joining us on the Landmines Show.
This has been a wonderful edition of Landmines brought to you by Foundation Stone. And please be in touch. Give us feedback. You're welcome to ask questions. Chodesh Tov!